Welcome to the HR Huddle podcast, presented by Sapient Insights Group, the ultimate resource for all things HR. It's time to get in the huddle.
Welcome to the HR Huddle podcast and to this special edition of Spilling the Tea on the HR Tech Conference. I'm Stacey Harris. It feels so good to be back on the conference floor, the official return of the HR Tech Conference put together by Steve Bowes and the phenomenal team at LRP. This year was significant. It was our first time being in person since the pandemic. I not only got to see so many of your faces, even if they were behind masks, I also got to do something I'm truly passionate about, present the findings from Sapient Insights annual HR system survey. This year's data was brimming with even more groundbreaking insights that many of the top organizations in the world rely on, especially in the wake of COVID-19. If you weren't able to attend, you can access the report and all our cutting-edge findings by heading over to sapientinsights.com and signing up for a free webinar on October 27th. We'll break out critical trends on vendors, systems that impact workforce planning, and what areas you need to invest in 2022. You can also become a subscription member right now for less than $300 for the entire year. You will instantly unlock the industry's most powerful research and data sets from our HR system survey, collected from 20,000 organizations and nearly 300 million employees across 80 countries around the globe. Speaking of our incredible team, many of whom were with me at HR Tech in Las Vegas, they are joining me to help serve you our top five hottest takeaways from the conference. Team, say hello to our listeners.
Hi, I'm Susan Richards, CEO and founder at Sapient.
Hi, I'm Joel Madovar, HR and finance industry analyst for Sapient.
And Pam Jefford, senior partner leading the diversity, equity, and inclusion practice.
Fantastic. Let's kick off this list, shall we? Taking the number five spot of the hottest takeaways from HR Tech is wellness. It's been at the forefront of HR for the last 2 years from a COVID-19 management perspective, as well as a mental health issue for organizations across the nation. At the conference, we heard more intentionality and nuances around this topic about how companies can leverage well tech to support employees in unexpected areas like diversity, equity, and inclusion. Pam, what are some of the insights you heard on this topic?
We've always known that wellness was important and always understood that not only will it reduce costs, but it is about the people at the end of the day. And how do we make sure that we have equity within our wellness programs, both from what are we paying for? What type of providers do we have for our employees? How are we talking about and making people comfortable talking about wellness, especially mental health? One of the things that we saw exposed during the pandemic was after the George Floyd murder was our Black professionals seeking out mental health services more than they had in the past. And we uncovered that we had very few Black professionals on the EAP. So we didn't have any Black mental health therapists. And so when our employees reached out to get these services, it was just a startling gap. And it's one that we hadn't seen before. It made sense once we uncovered it. But it's not something that 2 years ago we would have realized was a gap because our Black employees were not seeking out that mental health services. So good things are coming. I do think that we're moving away from it being a cost reduction effort, but truly humanizing our healthcare plans to make sure that we're supporting our employees at every step.
Pam, you make a great point on that because being a person of color, I can't tell you how many times, whether in my civilian career or my military career, people of color came to me because of that reason. They felt comfortable and more assured. And the fact that we were able to highlight this gap now is a major step and will go a long way long term.
One of the things that I noticed this year was there were far fewer technology solutions about employee engagement and how do I feel today, kind of that fluffier side of wellness, and far more vendors, partners who were sharing information about actual healthcare, things that were tangible, COVID testing, providing solutions and biometrics, more so than I had seen in the past. It felt like we moved away from the nice, make you feel good kind of technology solutions and more to that pragmatic side of what do we really need to help our employees feel safe and be healthy in the workplace.
That is the heart of the conversation. When we move away from the fact that it's just an engagement metric and we move into sort of the practicality of what is most helpful to the employee. One of the applications that I just had a briefing with on this particular topic was Unmind. Great application, has a lot of focus on education, but I think there was a lot of conversation about, okay, how do we take it to the next step, which is finding the resources and filling out the organizations who need to expand on the conversation. Our fourth hottest takeaway on the list is the new wellness, financial services. I had a great briefing with is a small company called Bright Plan, who's been doing a lot of work in not just offering financial education, which is where we often see the wellness conversation go there, but they're also offering financial services at a hourly per employee level that we generally don't see it offered at. And they're offering a lot of different type of tools to help employees think differently about their financial needs and their capabilities. And it really is something that speaks very loudly, because I know when I entered the workforce, my family's background did not spend a lot of time in sort of teaching me how to manage my finances. It would have been an amazing tool set to have something that not only educated, but also gave me the services and the solutions as well. What she said to me, Neha, who was doing the briefing with us, was that she's seeing a lot of organizations come to her around diversity, equity, inclusion as it relates to the financial wellness conversation. Pam, the whole wellness conversation, I think, has to do with diversity, equity, inclusion. Are you seeing organizations actually take advantage of the idea that financial wellness is part of that as well?
I think a lot of companies have always wanted to have financial wellness education and training, but they haven't been able to figure out why. You know, why should they put money and invest into this? And when you think about diversity and equity specifically, what we know is that men do have more confidence in their ability to, that they are more financially savvy. And we see research a lot that says that men will say that they did very well on a financial test, but their scores come back much lower than women who say they didn't do well. One of the great pieces of research that Sally Krawcheck did with Elevest a few years ago showed that when women do not believe they are financially secure, it's really irrelevant whether they are or not. When they don't believe they are, they will not actually go for a promotion in their own job, in their own company. They will go seek a job at another company rather than risk their current job. So they have what, you know, we call sticky feet syndrome. And so they will stay in their current job. They don't want to risk it, but they'll go apply somewhere else to see if they can make more money. So if you can help your women and your historically underrepresented groups feel more financially secure, they will actually stay at your company and go for a promotion within your company. The more financially well we make all of our employees, the happier they are within your company, the more likely they are to stay and to continue to progress.
I wonder how well our HR colleagues are going to adopt this idea of financial wellness being part of the overall health of the organization. From my days of being in the HR organization, one of the things that we had to do was manage risk. And the last thing you wanted to do was provide any financial information that was anywhere outside the bare minimum, because you didn't want to be held liable. And I wonder how much that is still at play. And can we broaden the conversation with them to help them get more comfortable having financial wellness be part of the overall wellness program?
Susan, that's an excellent point. And I would suspect companies like Bright Plan would assume that risk and responsibility. So it's, in a way, it takes that burden away from the employer and places it on this third-party provider. I also wanted to mention that one of the things that struck me when we were talking to Bright Plan was that they not only provide digital-type content and services, but they also provide live advisory service as well, which I thought was really a differentiator, at least in my mind. You know, we stop and think about this. Financial wellness really fits into the mental health. Because if I am struggling financially and take on the stress that comes with that, it ultimately affects me physically in what I'm able to do and not do at work and at home. So I think there is certainly multiple dimensions to this that need to be considered.
Joe, you earlier mentioned a great story because you got a chance to sit through Abby Wambach's keynote presentation. And you were talking about one of the stories that stuck with you was about sort of what she was thinking about when she went off stage, when she won her award. Do you maybe talk through that? Because I think that leads right into this, which is sort of the comfort level with finances versus not.
She was sharing the story that when she won the ESPY award, she won it in the same year as Peyton Manning and Kobe Bryant. And the three of them are walking off stage. And she said that it was the best day and the worst day of her life. It was the best day because she had won an ESPY and was considered in the same conversation as Peyton Manning and Kobe Bryant. And it was the worst day because as she walked off the stage and she looked to her left and to the right, she realized that they were probably walking off thinking about how they were going to invest their fortunes that they were able to accumulate in their professional careers. Whereas she, who spent, I think, was 15 years as a professional soccer player, was worrying about where her next career was going to take her and the associated paycheck. Big disparity in that, and that really stuck with me.
This leads right into our third sort of big takeaway. Coming in at number three is pay equity. The topic kept coming up, especially in light of the Great Resignation and the labor shortages and the fact that in April of last year, we lost 3 million women alone, right, in just a single month or two. It's heart-wrenching to think about the fact that so much is tied to the financial conversation and pay equity conversation. Pam, you did an actual panel on this, and we had a full room. What were some of the big takeaways for you?
The biggest takeaway was that we no longer had to talk about the business case for why we need to do pay equity, right? It was now, how do we do it? How do we do it right? The role that technology has played, which is eliminating a lot of the manual calculations, is really not only driving the cost of doing pay equity down, but the time. And it's making it very fast to uncover where do we have opportunities where we've looked at all the legitimate drivers of pay. And now we've narrowed it down. And let's say there's 5% that we can't explain, that there's no other reason that this person is paid different other than that they are a woman or a person of color or from a historically underrepresented group. And now we can close that 5% pretty easily. And I won't say easily in terms of the money, because it does cost money, but we can make a plan to close that. And the technologies have come out like Syndio and Curo to advance that. Where the conversation now went is that 95% of what we would call legitimate drivers of pay, which say, I can tell you legally why this person is paid different than this person. Now it comes down to, are those right? So yes, I can tell you, I won't get sued for paying someone different if they have greater tenure or if they have more degrees or if they live in a certain city. But now it's, should we, right? And so that's where we are now, is challenging those 95% of legitimate pays, which if you ask me, I would rather focus on the 95% than the 5% anyway. So I thought it was a very interesting conversation and one that people were excited to have, which is, should this be the way that we compensate people and pay differently?
One of the things that really struck me was how we broadened the conversation. It wasn't just about pay, but it was about negotiating, being able to negotiate and how women are perceived in the workplace. One of the anecdotes that was shared was that women can negotiate for a salary up to two or three times before the hiring authority gets put out with them. And men have the ability to go back up to five times in that negotiation process. That was a real eye-opener for me. I wouldn't have even thought about that, because I tend to just negotiate until I feel like we've gotten to a good place. But not all women are comfortable doing that or allowed to do that.
To your point, so we've got people whispering in our ear that there's a meritocracy here. And so if there truly is a meritocracy, then that means that the best person's going to get tapped on the shoulder. We're going to pay you the right amount based on what you're doing. So sometimes I hear people criticize, saying, well, if a woman can't negotiate for their own pay, or if they're not going to raise their hand and go for promotion, they're not going to fight for that job, then maybe I don't want them. And I'm like, okay, I hear you. So you have to stop saying you have a meritocracy, because a meritocracy means I get to sit here and do my job and do a dang good job. And somebody is going to tell me when it's time for me to, some algorithm or some person is going to tap me on the shoulder in a meritocracy and say, hey, Pam, it's time for you to get this promotion. And then the meritocracy is going to make sure I'm getting paid fairly based on what I did. And so you can't have both. You can't say, why are these women not negotiating for better pay? Why are they not going for a job? And at the same time whispering, oh, there's a meritocracy. People are getting conflicting information. To your point, like, you know, maybe you negotiate a couple of times and then you trust the process. And we hope that we should be able to trust the process. The other conversation we heard was, how do we eliminate those barriers? So you've seen companies like Reddit that are completely doing away with the ability to negotiate pay at hiring. You can negotiate once you get in the company and through a promotion, but all jobs are posted with the salary and you can't negotiate. You're seeing states like Colorado, where I live, every posting, you have to post the range of the job so that people can understand what the job is posted at and start negotiating from there. You have companies who are saying, tell the person the range first and then ask them the question, what would you like to be paid? We may not be able to legally ask someone what their prior salary was, but if I just say, hey, Susan, what do you want to make? In your head, you're probably doing some math off of what you're making today, as opposed to me coming out and saying, hey, Susan, the range for this job is 110 to 130,000. What do you want to make? You're going to hopefully go 130,000. Thank you very much. Right. I mean, so I love that the conversation got elevated super quick to transparency of pay bands and salary as being one of the easiest change makers in this conversation. If we just were transparent about what the salaries were for jobs, then we would eliminate the need to negotiate and to rely on past pay.
There's a lot of stuff that gets lost in the talent acquisition area of compensation conversations that just never gets tracked and never gets back to the compensation analyst who basically set these bands in place. And the second application that I had a great conversation with is salary.com, which is along the lines of some of the other organizations you had mentioned, Pam. They just picked up a new analytics function this last week with the idea of doing more talent intelligence around job skills and tying those to specific compensation ranges so that you're doing skill matching with compensation versus background and experience or school that you came from. This is the kind of thing where we've really got to think broadly about not just the compensation, but is there that same kind of thinking can we put across all the other areas?
Skills are where we need to go. We know that. But focusing on the skills, paying for the skills, making sure that, more important, making sure people understand what are the skills you need in order to progress in the organization? What are the skills that we're going to need in the future so that I can make sure that if I'm willing to upskill or reskill myself to be more employable, that I know what skills to go get?
Yep. And rounding out the top two is internal mobility.
Yeah. We call it sticky feet syndrome, right? Where people love their boss. They love the job. They like what they're doing. So they may not want to move. And then their manager doesn't want them to move because how great is it to have the same person for 15 years that does the job well? You tend to have these really amazing people sitting underneath really good bosses. So we're starting to create dashboards to look at that, to say, show me that that talent that's getting fours and fives in their performance reviews, but hasn't moved in the last 3 years. And you will tend to find that it's not because they're lacking the desire. It's they're a little bit nervous to move and see what this next manager might bring to them. And again, we tend to see that in those historically underrepresented groups and women, especially women with families. Mobility right now, without the support of technology or strong career frameworks and architectures, rely on internal networks in order to progress in the organization. If you rely on internal networks, by definition, your majority groups are going to have stronger internal networks. The people with longer tenure are going to have stronger internal networks. And so it's always going to favor that majority group. So we have to also remember that if you're trying to encourage people to go out and network as a way to find out that new opportunity, that you are going to disadvantage new employees as well as those that have small networks. I often tell people when they say, Pam, what is that one thing that you could do to improve the diversity in your leadership ranks? I'll always say it's a job architecture and a career framework that do not rely on internal networks in order for me to develop my own career. Allow me to go find it on my own. And a lot of companies will tell you that's their preference, is that you navigate your own career, but they just don't give you the tools to do it, especially if you have a large company. So really leveraging the technology to set up alerts, putting the skills that are needed in jobs so they can go search for a skill rather than a job title. So all of those things, they don't sound super sexy when you're talking about D&I, but honestly, even our prior conversation around pay equity, if you don't have a very solid job architecture, you actually don't even know if you're not paying your people well. You're kind of guessing, right? The root of being able to tell whether you have equity within your organization from a hiring, promotion, and retention is to understand what your job architecture is so that you can compare those things to each other. So doesn't sound super cool, Stacey, but I always tell people start there in your diversity journey.
Pam, I have to share with you along the lines you're discussing. Years and years ago, we did a benchmark visit to a global technology company, and we spoke with the vice president of diversity. They have poor representation of people of color and women in their senior ranks. because she said she would go to each of the leaders in each of the various sections, and they would say, well, I don't have anybody that's ready. So she actually implemented a program that said, you will find the person who's the closest to being ready in your organization, and you will put them in the third slot of your career succession plan, and you will develop that person. She forced the conversation, and I loved it because she said within 2 years, she had like 14-15% increase in representation. And so they couldn't make the argument any longer. I'm sorry, I don't know who that is. There's nobody ready. Put that process into place and took away that networking piece.
Yeah, go find them. But I also think, Joe, you know, you're bringing up another point, which is when we look at succession planning processes that fail to deliver diversity, it's often because they only let people choose one person. And they'll have these slates and they'll pick one person. And what we know is from our biases, if we only get to select one, we tend to select the person who reminds us most of ourselves, right? Or somebody who reminds you of a proven success in the past. But if you're allowed to select two or three people, you see the diversity of that entire succession planning slate just phenomenally grow. I'll tell you the data point that I always, you know, go back to is there was a study done of kindergartners. And when kindergartners that did a beta test, half of them were able to select their snack for the entire month. And they selected it the first day of the month for the entire 20 days. And then the other group selected their snack every day at the beginning of the day. And those that had the ability to select 20 different snacks at one time selected diversity in their snack. So it was like Skittles versus M&Ms versus, you know, Starburst. But there was some differences in what they selected. But the kids who selected their snack every morning selected the same snack every morning because they knew it was proven. I like Skittles. I'm going to get Skittles today. And then the next day, ooh, I'm going to get Skittles again. Maybe tomorrow I'll get Starburst. Nope. Next day, I'm going to get Skittles again. So in the succession planning, if you only get to pick one, you're going to pick the thing that you know most, which is what did the person before the success look like? I'm going to get that same person. Forcing that third person to be somebody who's ready future is great. But also just the fact that you're giving them three boxes, that's going to create more diversity as well.
Yeah. And we saw, I think, some really interesting technology that fits into this conversation as well around sort of behavior-based selection models that are focused more on potential and less on historical background or how long you've been with the company or your network. There was a great tool called Plum. We did a great briefing with Caitlin, who's the CEO. Joe, you got a chance to sit in on that. You've got to check adverse effects and you've got to check sort of the science behind these kind of assessments. But what I really loved is that she's starting to leverage this tool, not just for a talent acquisition conversation, but for what we just talked about, which is succession planning and development within the organization, which is the opportunity to say, you know, do you have people in your organization who are in roles that you wouldn't normally look at, but who match up from a behaviors perspective with some of the really important things that you think are valuable in your leadership roles? Susan, before we jump from this final conversation, I know you spent a lot of time sort of sitting in on some of the sessions. Any of those have conversations about internal mobility as well?
There were lots of conversations around internal mobility and identifying resources inside the organization who have potential and capability that we're not looking at. And the thing that really struck me as a practitioner and as someone who helps organizations implement complex technology solutions is that the things that we were talking about at HR Tech around the talent marketplaces, you know, all of the vendors, all the partners were introducing some sort of talent marketplace, some sort of enhanced skills tracking capability, the ability to introduce career frameworks. There were all kinds of cool tools that were being introduced. But what happens in reality is by the time an organization gets through an implementation, they are out of funds and out of resources and out of energy. The thing that I took away from those conversations is that as an advisor, I am going to do a much better job of promoting those tools that can drive the value, things like the talent marketplace and skills tracking tools, so that internal mobility becomes as important as attracting those external candidates. Because the dirty secret in HR is, you know, we're going to spend a whole lot more time and energy attracting people from the outside than we are on retaining those that we have inside our organizations. And that's a tragedy.
Yeah, it echoes what we're seeing in the survey as well, right? I can't tell you how many times we saw people say, you know, we have plans to implement the skills management side of this or the succession planning side of this, but it's not part of our current strategy for our HR technology blueprint. And coming in first place on our list of the top five hottest takeaways from 2021's HR Tech Conference is, drumroll please, technology. But not technology for the sake of technology or replacing HR professionals with more automation. The fundamental question we heard in our deep dive was around technology as a catalyst to enable HR to be more human. Where did you guys hear that in the conversations you were having?
Yeah, I saw it in the Marcus Buckingham presentation, some of the implications that he brought to the table, encouraging frequent HR interactions, some of the research that he and the ADP group had done, and how the role of technology is not to replace HR, but to enable HR to be more present, to be more attentive to the talent inside the organization. I sat in on Jason Lauritsen's presentation on compassion as a key skill for managers, this idea of HR leaders and managers being more human and being more open and authentic with our employees. That will be a competitive advantage going forward.
I sat in on Marcus's presentation as well. And one of the things that stuck out to me was when he was talking about HR and the perceived value, and one of the top three factors was the fact that when an employee has an HR point of contact, person they go to, they feel that HR provides value. And that speaks to everything you've all said, which is, you know, more of the human element. As I thought about it, I do think that technology should be an enabler. And for years and years and years, we've talked about how employee self-service, manager self-service was going to free us up to be able to be more strategic. Perhaps the challenge today is that technology should enable, free up some of these transactional work to allow them to put more of the human element back into the HR piece of that.
I think the challenge there is going to be, is HR able to become more human, or should it be a totally new department? When you think about the role of HR in the past has been risk mitigation, especially when it comes to things like sexual harassment or any type of discrimination and racial discrimination. The way that HR has been trained is coming from a place of risk mitigation, asking questions, determining our risk, determining how fast I need to elevate this. So I think, Joe, somebody needs to take the role of being a human, because I do think we're going to start to see more things get shared. I'm not using the word reported, because that in itself brings this idea that there's an investigation. But I think you're going to hear from employees what's really happening, what things are really making them leave, but only when someone on the other side is actually going to listen to them and care about what they're saying and thinking about that person as opposed to thinking about the company and risk mitigation. So I don't know that it's HR, but I totally agree with you. That needs to be a role. So let's call it something else.
Maybe we need to put risk management back where it belongs, which is with the risk management department. Most organizations have one, and we've gotten away from managing risk around people in that function, and we gave it to HR, and HR took it. Let's give it back.
Yeah.
Oh, I like it. Let's throw it back.
Exactly. Because we see this come up in the data, right? This balance between risk and how much money we're going to spend and whether or not we want to have these conversations that are going to open up this can of worms in some sense. A lot of times organizations don't even want to put forward engagement surveys because they know that the engagement's low. What do I do with that if I don't have the capacity to make changes? Do I really want to have that conversation? We talk a lot about HR being the mirror. You are one of the only functions in the organization that can stand up and say, you may say that this is what you value, but this is what you're doing, because we capture the data on the behaviors that no one else is capturing. We spend a lot of time talking about the experience of the technology. And in many cases, the answer might be less technology and more human conversations. And the technology enables us to have the time for that, which I think is where you were going, Joe.
I would think that HR should be the banner carrier for that. You know, it should permeate other functions. And how do I train other functions to be a little bit more human in my day-to-day interaction? And if you think about it, that point I mentioned earlier, you know, why do employees value HR more when there's a single point of contact? Because there's a human interaction. And it's not an employee portal. I'm not going to some chatbot to talk about, how do you want to change your benefits today? there is something that we need to think about, especially in this era of a pandemic and the needs of our employees.
Like an ombudsman. Don't you have an ombudsman or something in the military, Joe, that you can go to, right?
We called it ADF, Area Defense Council, ADC.
Okay. Well, I was thinking, who's the person you can go to, again, that doesn't have the requirement to turn it in issue? Like,
chaplain.
Like, who can you go to? That's what we need.
Yeah.
The chaplain. Okay. All right. We're going to solve this. We're going to figure it out.
You call me Chaplain Joe, and I'll take care of all you.
There you go. Yeah. Joe's going to solve it for everyone.
Among the many services we provide.
Yes. We did see, I think, overall in the conference this year and from the annual HR system survey this year, I don't know if you want to call it the year of being grateful or the year of sort of just generally giving a pass to sort of the vendor community, the support systems, but HR itself did not believe that they had added more value this year. It was such an odd, I think, juxtaposition to what we're just talking about. And maybe it's because of this missing human element, because there was so much risk mitigation conversation and support roles, but there wasn't enough conversation about the human side. We ask every year, what is the perception that the organization has of the HR function? And I really thought this year we were going to jump above that 45-46% mark, and we didn't. We went up to just 46%, which is the same place we were at 2 years ago because we dropped down last year. HR really needs to figure out not only what its perception is in the market and what its value proposition is, but it has to believe in its own value at this point in time. Sort of a wrap up for each of you. Is that something that HR can do for itself? Or is that something that we think the technology can help us do? What is that answer to help HR believe in the value that it's bringing to the organization?
A more powerful tool is for HR to start articulating the value that we bring to the organizations, really showing where we're cutting costs, where we are increasing the return on investment in tools, technology, solutions that we bring, and looking at things a little differently and getting out of that risk management set of activities and really thinking about activities that can drive value, like increasing our ability to move people around the organization, retain key talent, being a more inclusive organization. There are all kinds of ways that we can increase our value and bring a more positive light to HR.
This pandemic provides HR an opportunity to take the momentum, take all the goodwill that it's earned from its leaders who recognize it now as critical function during this period, and take that momentum and carry it forward and do all the things that Susan discussed here. You know, number one, start believing in itself.
Yeah. And Pam, you want to bring us home?
Absolutely. One of the things that I will say we saw very clearly is Susan talked about behaviors, right? Is we saw that when we were going through this pandemic together, we gave everybody three behaviors to do. We said, wear a mask, physical distancing, and wash your hands. We added a fourth, which was vaccinations. And those were four things that were globally relevant across the world that we all did. We didn't get super complicated on everything else. We said four things, but at the time three, right? And then we described them. What does it mean to wear a mask above your nose, but below your mouth? What does it mean to wash your hands? What does it mean to physical distance? 6 feet apart, we put signs on the floor. When we're going forward, when we're talking about behaviors, not being so vague anymore about what we mean, especially when it comes to human resources, let's stop assuming people know what we're talking about. Let's describe it. Let's give behaviors. Let's list it out. Let's show pictures. I mean, again, we learned so much about going through this. I want to make sure that we don't lose those things and go back to being vague again or super aspirational. It's like, let's get tactical. Give me the three things. Tell me what to do. Describe what you're expecting me to do. And then I think we can move some of these big issues forward.
I love that. You know, sometimes simplicity is the best answer in the human technology design, as we talked about, in how we explain and communicate, but also in how we think about sort of the policies and the approaches we're putting in place in cover from a humanity perspective, what we want to make sure our organization looks like. That wraps up our inaugural list of the top five hottest takeaways from this year's HR Tech Conference. If you want to hear more state-of-the-art trends, you can access the full report and all of our cutting-edge findings by heading over to sapientinsights.com and signing up for our free webinar on October 27th. Thank you again to my talented teammates for spilling the tea with me and to all of you. We'll be back before you know it with another fresh brew. In the meantime, make sure you subscribe or follow and share the show with a friend, because when everything goes to hell in a handbasket, it's time to huddle up with a crew you can count on. We will see you in the HR huddle.